House Transportation Committee to order. President Representative Keller, Salmon, Dugan, Johnson, Newman, and myself. Today, we're doing overview of aviation, and we're going to kick it off with rural airports, and Mr. Richards is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Frank Richards, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Transportation and Public Facility. Appreciate the opportunity today to talk about our airport systems in Alaska. But before I get started, I'd like to recognize some of the people that I have here with me today. We have with us Christine Klein. Christine is our new Deputy Commissioner for Aviation that started on February 1st. After many years of working at the international system and then also working in the private sector, she's decided to come back and help us out on the airport statewide. So welcome, Christine.
Thank you. We'll look forward to working with you all. I think I've worked with most of you in other capacities in the private sector, and from here on, I will be representing Department of Transportation and Aviation. So it's great to see you all again. Thank you.
And for the committee, Ms. Klein has extensive family in Ketchikan, so be nice.
And pilots.
Mr. Chair?
So be pilots.
Did she graduate from Wasilla High in 82?
I'm not sure about that, but her little sisters are my constituents, so just everyone needs to understand. Anyway, that's a joke.
Also with us today, we have Jesse Vander Zanden, who is the Fairbanks Airport manager. He'll be presenting after me. And we also have John Parrott, who is the deputy director at Anchorage International Airport, who will be presenting the Anchorage information. And again, the illustrious Mary Soroki, who puts this all together for us. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I will start talking about what we're going to talk today in regards to the rural airport system. And I'll note that this is one of our, the photo right here is one of our unique airports. It is a Little Diomede heliport. And it's really, the community is right at the base of that cliff. Community buildings and a heliport. So that's their primary egress and access for medical evacuations. And today I'm going to talk to you about the status of our rural program, identify what the challenges are and how we're addressing them, and what the future holds for us. Within the state, DOT is the largest owner of publicly owned airports. There are approximately 30 other airports that are owned by cities and villages and some other agencies like DNR. We have airports in approximately every village within the state. Some are still very short, as these numbers depict, 70 runways less than 3,000 feet and 22 runways less than 2,000 feet. We're trying to address those substandard airports by building them up to what we now have as a minimum standard of 3,300 feet. Our budgets are approximately $28 million of operating budget and $173 million worth of capital budget. Primarily, the capital funds come to us from the Federal Aviation Administration. Again, as the picture depicts, we have very unique operations within our airport system. We are the largest airport operator within the United States, and we have very challenging wildlife conditions sometimes to interact with. This particular polar bear was at the Barrow Airport, and we were successful in driving it off without having to dispense of it. On a rural system, most of the communities are maintained under contract with a local individual. Those contracts are for the individual to utilize the state equipment to keep the runway free of snow and ice and degrade the runway in the summertime for smooth operating surface. Those contracts average about $12,000 per year per individual.
Mr. Richards?
Mr. Chairman.
For the folks that upkeep as you said, the airports you're under, do they make, they must make their own capital investments in equipment and things like that. Is that how it works? Or?
Mr. Chairman, actually the state, through utilizing the federal aviation funds, purchases the equipment and the equipment storage building. So we hire the individual really to operate the state-owned equipment. We provide the lights, we provide the lighting parts, we provide the electricity to operate the lights. So the individual is really there to operate just the equipment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Richards, so, and just so when we're going through these now,
do you subcontract, like the maintenance and plowing, to an individual or a company in a lot of these rural airports? And then I think you just said that the state owns the equipment in the storage shed, so you provide for fuel. But like for the plowing and stuff, do you subcontract that out generally?
We actually, it's a one-year bid with 4 years of annual renewal. So they are actually low-bid contracts that we put out in most of the rural airports.
Okay, to private contractors.
To private contractors.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think in total there's 170 private contracts out there. So many instances we work with individuals, but if no individual comes to the table, then we work with the local community to, if they have an incorporated city, then we'll utilize the city to maintain the airport. We also have in our rural system what are called certificated airports. Those are airports that receive aircraft with more than 30 passenger seats. Essentially, those airports where Alaska Airlines and Era Aviation fly. New situation after Southwest Airlines went long in Midway Airport in Chicago due to braking action. There was a requirement by the Federal Aviation Administration that those types of aircraft, turbine-driven aircraft, would only land when braking action on paved surfaces were in the fair condition. That meant that it was relatively clear of snow and ice, and that by friction measurements, you got an indication of a fair braking action. That's requiring the state-owned airports that receive the jet traffic to do a lot more effort to clear the snow and ice in advance of those aircraft. So that is proving to be more of a challenge for us because that has just gone into play over the last year. We're also providing increased levels of service at some of the most busier airports, such as Nome, Bethel, Dillingham, Petersburg, and Wrangell. And with the help of the legislature, we were able to get additional operating dollars for that over the last couple of years. Our regional boundaries, as you see here, between northern, central, and southeast, are how our airports are managed, operated, as well as the design and construction efforts for those airports within those regions are done out of our regional headquarters in Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. The operational challenges that we have are increasing federal regulations and requirements ranging from security provisions to new runway marking standards to wetlands mitigation. Compounding this are the high cost of materials to construct and operate the airport. This particular airport is Sitka, and we are currently in an environmental impact statement for Sitka to build out what is known as a runway safety area. You'll see the runway depicted top to bottom, and a safety area is essentially an area surrounding that runway out to about 250 feet off center line and 1,000 feet off each end. So in Sitka, on that top part of the runway, it drops off to about 80 to 100 foot of depth right away. So to build out 1,000 feet of material and riprap is literally going to cost hundreds of millions of dollars. We're not going to do that at Sitka because the FAA has capped us at approximately $35 million for runway safety area improvements. So this is a particularly extreme case in terms of what it would cost to build out to those FAA standards.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Richards, I imagine you have a judging system there. You've got that money from the federal government to improve these airports. How do you decide which airports you're going to spend that money on?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, on those certificated airports, that is the FAA has set a national goal that all certificated airports will have runway safety areas up to standards by 2013. In Alaska, they have made an extreme push to provide additional monies to the state to cover those extra expenses. So that means that discretionary money beyond the entitlement funds that we receive on an annual basis, FAA has been willing to go nationally and pull that money into Alaska to cover those costs. We do have to go through a practicability analysis utilizing FAA standards, and that practicability analysis determines whether or not we're going to expend the full-blown safety area requirement or if we're going to go with something less.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I heard you say that we're required to meet certain criteria by 2013, or there's a date in there. We've got an airport that can't meet that. Are we going to lose certification on those airports? Are we going to, are they going to restrict jet aircraft? What's the repercussion if we don't reach that certification? Are there exemptions, you know, in the works, or are we just going to have to start flying, not flying jets into those?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, we are on track to meet the FAA guidelines by 2013. We're having to go through the environmental process on many of these. However, we have two airports, particularly on the Dalton Highway, Jim River and Galbraith Lake, that we are in discussions with the FAA on those two particular ones, because we don't feel, based on the traffic going into there, that it necessarily warrants that. So it would be, the FAA would be very hard pressed, I think, to pull the certificate from us, but we are having those discussions.
Just to follow up. So we will be dumping 800 feet of rock, 1,000 feet in the water at Sitka?
Not at Sitka, no, sir. They came up with a practicability study, and it capped us about $35 million. And I believe we're going to put in 200 to 300 feet at most.
And I guess that's the question about certification. Are they going to exempt Sitka from that 1,000-foot requirement?
Yes, as long as the practicability study has shown what we can reasonably do for this amount of money, they'll accept that as meeting the standard. Even though it's something less, we've gone to the extent to meet the intent of the law.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Salmon.
The question I have is mostly pertain to the rural airports and their fueling system. And the question I have is a lot of the off-river and even some of the river system have fueling problems, especially bringing the fuel, like Everett's Air bringing the fuel into some of the communities, Everett's or, you know, any one of those companies. And a lot of times you couldn't leave your, you know, like if you're a private person, you couldn't leave your barrels or anything on the airport, and that seems to create problems. And is the state DOT thinking about...
We lost the sound, so we're not recording right now.
Okay.
I hate to interrupt, but we'll take an Eddie's just for a minute.
Okay.
Sorry, we got you right in the middle of your sentence.
Yeah, I apologize. I think it started just as...
Magnetic personality. It's a plot against rural people, Woody.
Yeah. It's all part of the conspiracy.
My fault.
I think it was just...
I'm glad we got a resident expert here at the meeting.
Exactly.
Okay, we're on.
Are you on?
Yes, we're fine.
Okay, the question is, I have is the fueling system for private industry, like... It doesn't matter whether it's Fort Yukon or any other villages. A lot of times you don't have no fuel tankers or anything to come to the airport to, you know, get the fuel and stuff like that. And sometimes you have to use barrels or, you know, tanks to fuel the system, and you couldn't leave it on the airport. And I think the state DOT needs to do something with that, you know. I mean, they say it's against the EPA regulations to be fueling these private areas, and... You know, and to me, about 75% of it is private, you know. You know, using the airport for fueling system. So I think in the long range, we need to look at that to, you know, alleviate some of the private industries, you know, to operate it more safely on the airports. I just wonder what your comment would be on that.
Through the chair, Representative Salmon, I certainly understand the challenge with folks, specifically with the high price of fuel and the inability of barges to get into certain areas to provide fuel and those means. But the challenge we've had with folks leaving fuel tanks and drums on the airports is sometimes those tanks and drums start leaking, and then the state ends up owning that responsibility. And they also become safety hazards, so that when our funding partner, the FAA, shows up to do some of their inspections and they see these safety issues, that's when they come down on us as the airport operator to provide for or not to have unregulated tanks just stored all over the airport. I understand that when Everett's comes in or another fuel carrier comes in, most folks will show up with their fuel tanks either in by pulled by snow machines or on four-wheelers or pickup trucks, get them fueled up, and then they'll depart the airport. That's a reasonable approach. It's having a designated area specifically to store tanks where there's a potential for contamination.
Yeah, what I envision is we have a pit area, you know, like, you know, for a containment area, mm-hmm. and have that, you know, where you could store facilities like that, you know. I mean, where if it leaks, you know, you have a containment area. I mean, it seems to me that would be the solution to the problem. And yet, you know, you don't, you know, see that in the future, you know. I mean, it seems like it's a fairly simple problem to resolve, but yet they make no effort to resolve that problem. And even a, you know, a piping system to, you know, where they could hook up to the airport and get it out into the, you know, like where you have private fueling area, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, seemed like it would be a very simple solution to this problem. I was just kind of wondering why they're not attacking it in this, you know, manner.
Well, through the chair, Representative Salmon, to my knowledge, when I've seen similar systems like that, I think Red Devil had actually one where you had a header pipe right there. The challenge that we had in that particular airport was the flooding and the erosion associated with it, and then the potential fuel contamination coming even out of that pipeline. I'd be glad to talk to you further about that opportunity, or, as I said, our new Deputy Commissioner of Aviation. But right now, the capital improvements that we spend on our rural airports are predominantly federal aviation monies. And to my knowledge, we have not built fuel systems and fuel tanks utilizing FAA money.
Well, then I guess we just got to break the law then, don't we?
Uh-oh. Frank, on... I'm sorry. On this issue of fuel out at rural airports and such, I noticed in the operating budget there was a couple $100,000 general fund to, it was explained, to clean up some of this stuff. What is your interaction with the DEC and their charge to keep the environment clean of such things? Or even to construct facilities, as Representative Salmon was talking about, that would have the proper containment and delivery systems. Do you work with the other department on coordinating that problem?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do. We actually have a good working relationship with DEC, especially on contamination found on state lands where there is not a known entity that created that, and then it's their state responsibility to clean it up. We have access to some of those DEC funds to help and cover and take care of those situations, but as we presented in our budget, the needs out there for the cleanups are far exceeding what DEC has available to give us. So that's why we identified it as a need to put into place, because we're getting abandoned cars and abandoned equipment and fuel tanks and drums out there from long gone residents and long gone leasers, and so we're left holding the bag, so to speak.
And one more question on the like Sitka you're doing, or as you explained to Representative Johnson, is the I think it's Wrangell and Ketchikan, are those similar projects?
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly correct. Wrangell is about a $31 million project that's underway right now.
And those projects, I understand, are kind of coming to us from above rather than DOT or the community requesting these projects. Is that correct?
You are correct, Mr. Chairman, because as you'll see, we have great needs across the state on our rural system, the smaller airports. And it was always our argument back to the FAA that we would rather build up an airport that is less than 2,000 feet to something like 3,300 feet and spend the money so that there's safer access to those communities rather than building the safety area demands requirements of the FAA. So the FAA understood that argument and actually went out and acquired additional funding for us to be able to build to those new standards. So that's additional money that has come to the state that may not have otherwise come to us.
When folks at DOT add up the amount of money going into a district, in the broad sense of all projects. I just want to make it clear that that money, talk about an unfunded mandate, that is a funded mandate that I have articulated before, hopefully is not necessarily weighed too heavily in the decision-making process of project support with DOT, but that's just my own little...
The darn federal government's just giving you too much money.
Just giving us too much, Representative Dugan.
Mr. Chairman, certainly the safety area in Sitka. Those projects, again, are like Wrangell and I meant to say Ketchikan. That project is very similar to Sitka, as well as Wrangell and King Salmon and Dillingham and wherever else we're doing those. So there are additional monies that are coming to us. When we judge our projects, they're really based on need and the safety improvements that will be provided for them across the board. So there's no identification of previous monies put forward to an airport project that would sway the decision whether or not to go forward with the project.
I've heard that answer before. Thank you. If I could take like 45 seconds of the committee's time, it's kind of funny because in the extension of the airport Ketchikan, there is actually a road that is going under the runway, and they've got a culvert that is massive. It is absolutely huge. And we were driving through town with a friend of mine, and he looked over and saw the culvert, and he says, "Look at the size of that thing. You could drive a truck through that."
Mm-hmm. And often do.
I just thought it was funny. Anyway.
Can you drop that through the bay?
Mr. Chairman, if you would like the opportunity to go over there and see that project with the connecting roads that are being done.
I've been over there a couple times, yeah. And I think everybody else here has been at the airport this session at least once.
Well, we're glad you had a safe landing spot to fly into. If I may, Mr. Chairman?
Please continue.
With the Federal Aviation Administration, we have the safety area issues, we have environmental permits. What we're trying to do with the federal reauthorization of the Airport Improvement Program is to seek oversight of the environmental impact statements for the state of Alaska, because right now FAA has that responsibility. So that means FAA provides money to the state to make an improvement on a state asset, but then the oversight of the environmental impact statement by a consultant is directed by the FAA and not the state as airport owner. So we're trying to seek that oversight authority through the reauthorization so that we will then control our own destiny, so to speak.
Is that going to show up in the budget? Because we did primacy with DEC and that cost us a good amount of money, but it gave us more flexibility. Is this something that we expect that the state is going to need to spend money to go through this process? Is this going to show up in the operating budget somewhere?
Mr. Chairman, it would be very similar to what we did with the Federal Highway Administration seeking EIS oversight. And to my knowledge, I think we added one staff person for that. We were one of five states that had that ability under the reauthorization of the highway bill. And so we're moving forward to do that with one additional staff member.
Is that FHA staff member still a PCN number in the state?
It's a PCN within DOT.
Okay. So is this person going to be, not the budget committee, but is this going to end up being a permanent full-time position after we've obtained EIS oversight?
Mr. Chairman, my goal would be that existing staff member that's on staff with DOT that had gone through this process with FHA would essentially be able to do the very same thing with FAA and working with the FAA to gain that ability and authority within the department.
Thank you.
We also have the other federal regulator that we deal with on a daily basis is the Transportation Security Administration. You've all dealt with them through the screening checkpoints. We get to deal with them on airport security. One of our challenges is that when they give us security requirements through their regulations, they don't bring any money to the table and they ask us to then absorb it. One of the other issues is that we, instead of having one particular head director to oversee the airport security in the state of Alaska, we have three federal security directors, and that means that we then potentially have three different perspectives on the security regulations that we then must follow. And again, they're ever-expanding requirements. I believe you've seen this slide in Jeff's presentation about the cost of construction in Alaska, so I'll pass that by. Rural dust. The picture on the left is essentially generating dust in and around our airport. In this particular case, it's a brush cutter. In the rural airports, we have predominantly gravel runways, and the challenges that we're seeing is that the airports and the roads in the villages are sources of dust, such to the point that several villages, particularly in the Northwest, have actually gone to both DEC and EPA and complained about the dust levels in their communities being generated by the transportation, either by aircraft, four-wheelers, or vehicle traffic. And there have been instances when the air quality standards have been exceeded due to dust. What this means to us is potentially if the EPA, through continuous monitoring, identifies that the dust levels and those air quality standards are continually being exceeded, that they could identify the state of Alaska, rural Alaska, as a non-attainment area. What that would mean is that federal monies, transportation monies, could then be ultimately directed by the EPA and how we spend the monies, meaning we would have to come into the rural communities and take care of dust control. So it would mean potentially paving all the airports, paving the roads into town, and even paving four-wheeler trails. So that is a looming threat that we have out there. What we are doing is working in conjunction with DEC, and in this year's capital budget, you'll see that we have a request for some small equipment and dust palliative to go out and apply to the rural airports in the Northwest and into the roads in those communities, because we're seeing villages such as Kiana and Selawik have the need, and we want to be able to knock down that dust before it becomes a problem and we have the oversight of the EPA coming down on us. So it could potentially save us federal oversight coming in and retaining our ability to spend the money where we feel it's most needed. The picture on the right is actually Ms. Nunamiqua, where we did apply dust palliative, and it worked so well that the gravel runway, as you can see, has skid marks on it from the airplane tires. It bound up the surface very, very tightly.
So when you head out to these airports, you mentioned you're in conjunction with the roads to mobilize that. I mean, is that a lot of big pieces of equipment? Is it pretty easy to get them out there? I mean, I'm glad to hear that if you're going to go out to an airport and do it, you're going to take care of the roads as much as you can as well. Mm-hmm. Mobilization is a big cost. I don't know. But what are we talking about when we bring equipment out to a community like that?
Mr. Chairman, good question. We're going to model what the Nome nonprofit organization is called. I'm sorry, the name escapes me right now. But essentially, they've received monies over the last 3 or 4 years through Safety Lou to address issues of transportation, road transportation in the villages. What they have done is bought a six-wheeler and built a trailer with an applicator bar that spreads out approximately 10 feet wide that is air transportable in a CASA aircraft, and then shipped the dust palliative out to the communities and then applied it in approximately 19 communities in their region so far. That is what we're going to model. We're going to utilize the monies, if we receive it, to fund them, that organization, to do some more communities, and then we would have a mirror equipment that we would be able to spread out to more communities as well. So it's buying a six-wheeler that's air transportable. We're not talking a major water tanker truck, because the challenge would be, where do you store that equipment in the wintertime where it wouldn't freeze and where you wouldn't have potential for vandalism? So we want something that is easy and simple to get there.
I'm no pilot, but is it size-wise you can put it in pretty much any plane that can land on any of these airports out in the...
No. Mr. Chairman, CASA is an aircraft that has a rear tail that comes down, and you're able to drive right onto it. So it's very similar to, I think, the Caribou, that aircraft that the National Guard is now using in their fleet.
So in effect, the smallest runways and probably smaller communities are still gonna, won't be able to benefit from this. I mean, it's a good program, but.
I think that, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I believe that that CASA can probably get into 2,500, 2,800 foot runways. So there'll be a small number that it can't go to, but I think those in the Northwest Arctic, though, are sized large enough to handle that aircraft.
Representative Salmon and then Keller.
The question I have is how long does this, the new DUS, whatever they call it, last?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salmon, the organization that has been applying this is called COERIC out of Nome, and they're hoping that it'll get 3 years. They started their applications 2 years ago, and they're monitoring it now and hopefully getting 3 to 4 years. We put out applications, as you saw, in Nunumiqua. We put out applications in Chicken, and they are now in their second and third year and holding fairly well.
Follow up?
I think like about 10, 15 years ago, they were using that kind of like lignocyte, they call. And that one, I mean, the surrounding dust area, I mean, you could apply it on the runway, but the surrounding dust would get on it, and, you know, you still have that same dust problem, you know. So,
right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Salmon, we are actually using a product called EnviroClean now. There's several different dust palliatives that we are trying. It really depends on the makeup of the gravel. If it's a cationic or an anionic type of charged particle, how the dust palliative works with that particular material, as well as the amount of fines in the actual gravel.
Representative Keller?
Kind of building on the same questions, I assume you've done comparisons of cost of asphalt compared to the EnviroClean or whatever, and I was just wondering if there's any FAA requirements for a hard surface, you know, in a particular size runway. I mean, could this process be used on some of our bigger runways in lieu of asphalt? And that's kind of a question.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, we do a life cycle cost on the dust palliative as compared to pavement, and it is very beneficial in terms of using the palliative. The FAA doesn't have prohibition against using a dust palliative or a preference, I would say, dust palliative versus asphalt. They really leave it up to the airport operator to make that decision. We have, in some instances, like the community of Antioch, which was a 5,500-foot runway right through the middle of town. It was a gravel runway, but when large aircraft came in, C-130s or DC-6s or 737s, it created a dust plume that settled over the community, and we paved that runway. The foundation soils were going to be suitable for doing that, and we just made that determination that was going to be a better application.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, this chart right here is really just an indication of what our general fund operating budget is. The white line on the bottom shows the operating budgets for both our highways and airports budget within the Department of Transportation. And as you'll notice, we stayed fairly constant through the 80s and the 90s at about an $82, $83 million level. And at turning in about 2004, we started seeing some increases, and the legislature was very generous in providing us those needs, primarily covering the high cost of fuel and materials. But I throw this up here just to show the loss of buying power of those dollars over the time frame since 1983. And while we've had that loss of buying power, we've also built larger, brighter, wider airports and put in more amenities and facilities in our highways. So we're doing more with less is the general gist of this with the increasing assets that we're putting out there. Mr. Chairman, we're also experiencing the challenges of coastal storms and the impacts from flooding and erosion. Three of these communities you've probably heard of in the news repeatedly, Shishmaref, Kivalina, and Newtok. The coastal erosion is impacting these communities quite severely. The community of Newtok is the community that's out there in the lead right now and looking to relocate to its new village site of McTarvik. And we are working with the Denali Commission as well as the Department of Community, Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to help them with that effort. Future funding needs. These $955 million is essentially what our needs list are for our rural airports, primary and non-primary airports. The distinction between those two is primary airports are those that have 10,000 employments or more, and non-primaries are less than 10,000. So the spread of the needs is runways, buildings, equipment, but the dollar amount is what is quite staggering, $955 million. So, as I said previously, the predominance of the funding comes from the Federal Aviation Administration. They provide approximately 95% for eligible public airport development costs, and the airport sponsor, meaning the state, kicks in the 5% match. That's a wonderful benefit to us, and we're using the money, I think, very wisely. Our operating costs are all borne by the general fund. Last 2 years' appropriations under the AIP, which is the Airport Improvement Program, shows that the state of Alaska in total has received about $210 million, of which $173 million came to state of Alaska airports, including the international airport system. And you can see the spread there, approximately $123 million to rural system and $50 million of AIP funds to our international system. We're anticipating right now, although we are in a continuing resolution, that the FY08 numbers will be very similar to the 07 allocation. And this chart really just gives a comparison between the numbers between the Anchorage International Airport System, AIAS, and our rural system. So it runs approximately about 75 rural, 25 international. Then I just want to give you an indication of where the money is being spent and provide a few key examples. Mr. Chairman, in this particular case, you'll see the runway safety area and overlay at Ketchikan totaling about $34.6 million. And in Bethel, we've also built a parallel runway because the traffic patterns in Bethel and the aircraft that are now utilized in that airspace, it's a congested airport, and we actually had to build a second runway for them. And you'll see throughout this, these are our larger airports again, those mostly predominantly certificated airports, and we have a lot of runway safety area projects, so the numbers in there are very, very large, including King Salmon and Wrangell, and as well as Petersburg. Our non-primary airports are, again, those small village airports. What's been interesting to note in my time within DOT, what were normally $3 and $5 million relocation or reconstruction airports are now ranging $10 to $15 million for each particular airport.
Representative Salmon.
Up there you have Angoon Airport construction for $30 million. When is that project due to start, or what stage are they in right now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Salmon, we are just kicking off the environmental impact statement on Angoon. Senator Kukesh is very interested in this particular airport as it's his community. And the challenge is going to be, as you may know, it's surrounded by wilderness. So we're going to have to work with our federal partners to be able to carve out the space for that airport and get connecting roads from the community to that airport site. So we're anticipating that EIS will take a normal 3 to 4 years to complete in order to get this this work done. As you notice, as I go through these particular airports, the costs in the YK Delta airports are quite large. That's because in those airports, we normally have to import everything. Gravel's got to be barged there from somewhere else. I'm happy to say the middle of the pack here, Kongiganak at 19.2. This is an airport that the community has desperately wanted for a number of years, but there was always an issue of utilization of the federal money and waiver of sovereign immunity. And they have accepted now that they're going to waive that sovereign immunity, and so we're providing them with the money to be able to complete that airport and provide for a much safer facility than what they have now. As you can see with these project lists, we're getting a lot done and upgrading the airport so that we have more safer facilities for folks to be able to get themselves in and get themselves out in the case of medevac operations. For the future, we see that our aircraft fleet will likely change, and we're trying to anticipate what those changes are going to be so that we can provide the airports to meet those needs in the future. We have in front of us now a proposal by the United States Postal Service to create more bypass mail hubs. What that means is that the existing bypass mails that are currently going to places like Nome, Kotzebue, and Bethel would be, there would be additional hubs put into places like Hooper Bay and Kiana and Shishmaref, meaning that the mainline air carriers would be able to fly directly from Anchorage to those new hubs and distribute the mail to that community and those closer to those communities. The challenge is those new hub locations, the airports aren't sufficient to meet the needs of the aircraft that will be flying into them. So what the goal of the U.S. Postal Service is to save several million dollars a year by creating these hubs would require us as the airport operator to expend tens of millions of dollars to upgrade the facilities to be able to accommodate the airport, let alone the cost to the individual private carriers who would have to put in place infrastructure, meaning storage buildings and hangars, to be able to have to take the mail from those new hubs to the other locations.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Frank, so with the bypass mail, and that's been very controversial in Alaska with Alaska villages. They don't support it. So what the federal government did is so that they could save some money. Did you just kind of say a lot of that burden got shifted onto the state?
Through the chair, Representative Newman, it could get shifted on the state. That's why we have identified to the Postal Service that what those costs would be to upgrade those particular airports to meet those needs, and identified to them that we are just starting off on a statewide aviation plan update, and it would behoove the Postal Service to come in and talk to us as the airport operator to identify what their goals were so that we can look to see what funding mechanisms would be required to meet those needs. There is great opposition by the air carriers to this bypass hub creation. So we've identified what our concerns are to the U.S. Postal Service, and we will continue to have dialogue with them so that they don't just plop this down on us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And finally, Mr. Chair, the air cargo security regulations as promulgated by Transportation Security Administration are ever expanding. So it's now gone to air cargo, and that has meant now that those in our rural system, we've had to have designated security areas specific for each individual cargo carrier. So that's placed a burden on not only the airport, but more so on the air carriers, because they have to put in place these special provisions and badging requirements and criminal history background checks for anybody that's going to handle their freight. With that, Mr. Chairman, I am pleased to say I'm done, and I'll be pleased to answer any questions.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple of questions. So when you go to meet with those TSA guys in their building, do they make you take your shoes off?
Through the chair.
I was just wondering, because every time I see those guys, they make me take my shoes off, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if it was something about me or...
That's a good question.
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, when I go to the federal building, yes, I must essentially take all metal and shoes off of my body.
Well, I'm glad to see that they're not playing favorites, Mr. Chairman. When we talk about rural airports, I'm trying to get sort of an idea, if I was flying into a rural airport, what I would actually be looking at. There's going to be a runway, and you're trying to make sure that they're all, how long when you expand these ones that are too short? You want them to be
3,300 feet.
3,300 feet. Okay, and if they're 3,300 feet, what kind of aircraft can get in and out of them?
Well, at 33, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Dugan, a Navajo, a Cherokee, a 207, the new Caravans, the 208s, other small twins. So it's those small 6 to 9 passenger seat aircraft that can fly in there.
If I might, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. And in addition to that, there's going to be some sort of building that's going to have some kind of equipment in it, right, for clearing the runway and doing that sort of thing?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, yes. With the addition of a runway, a taxiway, and an apron, we do build equipment storage building, as well as provide equipment to maintain that.
And what kind of equipment are we talking about there?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, it's primarily a grader, a small grader, probably in the 34,000-pound class, and then we will provide a loader with a bucket and probably a push plow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just trying to sort of understand this. But there's not necessarily going to be any other building there. There's not going to be any general-use fuel storage facilities. We're talking about, I'm trying to figure out what makes this an airport instead of a runway. When I think of an airport, I generally think about a building that you can go into, but it doesn't seem to me that I'm hearing that there are such buildings.
Representative Dugan, you are correct. We are not creating terminals, if that's what you're looking for.
Okay.
In regards to.
But are there going to be, there's going to be lighting at most of them? Are there going to be navigational aids?
Representative Dugan, yes, we do put, on the land side, we'll put runway lights. And if the FAA, based on the traffic loads going in there, will possibly put in visual aids, whether they be PAPIs or VASIs. And then there's been a large number of GPS approaches that have been put in, so there's not necessarily the ground-based infrastructure at the airports as there were in the past.
Okay. It seems to me that my friend from Interior Alaska has a point. I'm just trying to sort of figure this out. So I'm flying a plane into one of these airports, and I can't refuel because there's no fueling capacity. Then it's going to be tough to go into too many of them because then I'm going to run out of fuel and bad things are going to happen. So you're going to have to go back to some sort of, either you're going to have to land next to your house where you've got fuel, or you're going to have to go to some sort of regional hub airport, which I would assume would have fueling capability. Am I correct in that?
Yes, you are. Most of the large airports have private fuel vendors. Through the chair, Representative Dugan, a lot of the rural airports do not have any aircraft that reside there. They're predominantly the access and egress points for the community members to seek foodstuffs, as well as get to medical facilities and commute between the villages.
Right. So you're telling me that basically a commuter airline, some sort of air taxi, some sort of air service is going to fly in and out of these runways. And so the ability to refuel is not necessarily as important as it might be if there were going to be a fleet of resident private aircraft there. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, that's correct. What I think Representative Salmon was talking about was the ability to receive fuel for heating oil, as well as fuel and for snow machines, not necessarily avgas.
I see.
Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. And if I remember correctly, to bring how much money is it going to cost to bring those sorts of airports up to the standard that the department would like it to be?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, what we're seeing for reconstruction and or relocation, our costs are in the $10 to $15 million per airport range. Some are less, some are considerably more. I think our current estimate for Lime Village is in excess of $24 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further questions on rural airports? Seeing none, we're going to take a brief of these. Well, I think we're doing Fairbanks next. Uh, We'll get back on the record, and for the record, Representative Faircloth has joined us. Please identify yourself and your position for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Jesse Vander Zanden, and I'm the manager of Fairbanks International Airport.
Thank you.
Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. It's a pleasure and an honor. My presentation today is about 15 minutes long, and of course, if there's any questions in between or anything like that, I'd be happy to try and answer them. Let me just get started here. For an overview today, I'd like to take you through Fairbanks' capital improvement program, our passengers, cargo, business, and then just general aviation. And that came out a little blurry. I apologize about that. A couple things that we've done at the airport here over the past 6 years or so is on the east side, our general aviation side of the airport, we extended one right, one nine left to 6,500 feet, and we put in a ski strip of approximately 3,000 feet, and also at ski and gravel. We did that in 2001 and 2. In 2000, and we also expanded the float pond as well. The gravel that came out of that float pond was the same gravel that went to build those two runways. In 2004 through 6, we rebuilt our taxiway, and we included de-icing pads on the end. The de-icing pads are where they use glycol. And what that enables us to do is isolate the glycol used to either end of the runway, and in doing so, remediate it much less expensive than we were before. This project is our cargo apron. It is being moved from our terminal, which I'll explain why in just a moment. It should be complete this summer, and as with the old cargo apron, it's four positions. Our existing cargo apron is just south of the terminal, which I'll show you in just a minute. And then as far as the airfield, the last project that we have, which we will get started on this summer, is our main runway. And the red spot, the red area there, which is our current taxiway, the work that will happen this summer is to get that ready for use as an alternate runway. And once that is complete, we will begin landing planes in the red area in 2009, which enables us to get out onto the airfield and rebuild one left, one nine right, our main runway. And then the last thing that we have is our terminal development. That's that little green spot that popped up toward the top near the middle there. As you can see, the way the terminal is configured, we have operational conflicts with our existing hard stands, and that's why we had to move them to the south. I do want to go into a little bit more detail with regard to the terminal, since it's the one that everybody sees when they fly in and fly out and drive up every day. So I would like to spend a little bit of time on that. That didn't come out very well, I apologize, but our old terminal was approximately 143,000 square feet. The new one is going to be slightly bigger, 152,000 square feet. It's much better utilized, however, and in doing so, we actually gained some internal square footage, not from an overall amount, but from a utilization perspective. Our initial budget was $99.2 million. Our current forecast right now is to come in at approximately $93.5 million. And our estimated completion date is October 1st, 2009, and currently I'm happy to be able to say that we're ahead of schedule. So we are going to open the new part, which you see right there with the glass. The official opening date for that is May 7th of this year, and then we'll go into the part to the left, which is the older portion, and when we finish that, that'll be the last part of the project, which I can show you actually right here. So the blue part will open up May 7th, and the existing terminal will remain open. In the summer of 2008, this coming summer, the blue part right there, which is actually, if you've ever flown into Fairbanks, the middle portion is where you pick up your bags. That'll be slated for demolition this summer. The regionals will continue to use the north end of the building, or the white section, throughout this summer and all the way through next winter. And then finally, completion of the project in the spring of 2009. The yellow part, which is essentially the main building, will be fully complete, and all that will be left to do is demolish the 1952 portion of the building.
Did I understand you correctly that the project is under budget and ahead of schedule?
It is.
Excellent.
Yep. So, these are just some renderings. I just thought it'd be kind of interesting to show you what the designer came up with and what exists right now. So that's what the new terminal will look like in the spring of 2009. This is what it looks like today. And then moving on, with respect to passenger service, from domestic passenger service, I should clarify that, we've had steady growth over the past few years. You will see a slight dip, I think, that every airport experienced due to 9/11. As far as new service, Delta came to the airport in 2004. They are slated to expand their service this year, or this summer, and that's seasonal service. Alaska expanded their service in 2007. They added a couple additional flights, one to Seattle, and I believe they added another frequency to Anchorage. ERA is new in 2007. That's three flights per day to Anchorage. So we actually have a total of 15 business flights per day to Anchorage. Not necessarily business, but just 15 flights per day to Anchorage. And then the last is what's called a SCADSD grant. It's a Small Community Air Service Development Grant. We were fortunate enough to get a grant from USDOT for approximately $500,000. That is the grant that we are using to attract additional airline service, in this case, direct to Denver. From the international perspective, it's been a good success story for us. We have direct charters out of Narita, Japan, that fly into Fairbanks, and those charters have skyrocketed over the past few years in terms of frequency and also numbers of passengers. That airplane right there is obviously a 747, and when it pulled up, it deplaned the most passengers that we'd ever had deplane at once at Fairbanks, and there was approximately 392 folks on that plane right there. Condor Thomas Cook is a direct flight to Frankfurt, and it's been not quite the meteor growth that JAL has experienced, but it has been steady growth for us. And that is not a charter. That is direct service to Frankfurt. So anybody in Fairbanks or wherever can fly direct to Frankfurt, Germany, and that's been very successful. From a cargo standpoint, it hasn't been as good a news. We did lose our Europe to Asia traffic predominantly because of the opening of the Russian airspace. They have four-hour block time savings. And from an economic perspective, it's extremely difficult to compete, if not impossible. We do serve as the primary diversion for Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. As a result of some of our cargo leaving, as a result of the Russian airspace, we do have room for growth, and we are currently underutilized on our airfield. Very similar to Anchorage, we do have cargo transfer authority. We are 9.5 hours from 90% of the northern industrialized hemisphere. I already talked about the loss of Europe to Asia traffic. We did pick some back up, however. Volga-Dnieper Charters is new in 2006, and that's not scheduled service per se from cargo, but it is an uptick in business that we were encouraged to see. And then last, two other non-airfield revenue sources for airports are land revenue and concession revenue. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of these. Our concession revenue, predominantly because the number of people transiting in and out of the airport has gone up, just because we've had more people flying through the airport. And also land revenue has gone up significantly, and that's predominantly because we've been leasing quite a bit more land. I think we've executed approximately 12 leases in the past 3 years. And so our revenue has gone up significantly for land revenue.
Representative Salmon?
Pardon?
Representative Salmon had a question.
Chair, Representative Salmon.
I have a question on those restaurants. Why? How come they put them in the secure area rather than non-secure area?
Well, that in the existing terminal.
That's where the yes.
Right, Chair, Representative Salmon. In the new terminal, it's going to change.
Thank you.
That's all I need. That was easy.
Coffee shop. Yeah.
That was an easy one. And then for general aviation, as I highlighted earlier, we do have two runways, paved and gravel / ski strip. Float pond, we have 185 spaces, and we currently have room, so which is good. At tie downs, we have 365 spaces, 150 of which are electrified. We also have a pilot's lounge and an airpark. So come fly with us. Any questions?
Representative Faircloth?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Specific to Fairbanks International, what's your, does your revenue meet your expenses?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, no.
And what's your deficit?
Pardon?
What's your deficit?
Our current, excuse me, Chair, through the, Representative Faircloth, our current deficit, net of depreciation or including depreciation?
Both.
Okay. I can get back to you with specifics, but I, generally speaking, with depreciation, it's approximately, you're searching my memory banks here, I think it's approximately $9 million, and without depreciation, it's approximately $4 million.
And does that include then the contribution from Anchorage International to you in that equation, or is that a deficit that's in addition?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, all of Fairbanks and all of Anchorage's revenue goes into the same pot, and it's the enterprise fund. We don't get any general funds through the legislature, and then all the expenses come out of the same pot. And so in answer to your question, yes, it we don't put as much into the pot as we take out, and Anchorage puts more into the pot than they take out.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just to clarify then, did you just give me Anchorage numbers or the pot's numbers?
No, I gave you Fairbanks' numbers.
Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions? Just generally on, you mentioned during cargo, the something happened with the Russian airspace that is affecting traffic. Is, I guess, what are you guys brainstorming to try and pump that back up? I mean, is that just a function of time and flight patterns, or is there some way that, how are you trying to increase your cargo frequency, I guess?
Well, there's kind of two distinct markets out there, so to speak. One is the U.S. To Asia and vice versa, Asia to U.S., and the other one is the Europe to Asia. And it's the Europe to Asian market that is really kind of, if it hasn't totally left Alaska, but it's a lot of it's left. And it's predominantly because if you envision kind of the globe, so to speak, and you're in Europe, if you just turn your plane the other way and you fly mainland over Russia, you're going to get to Asia a lot quicker than if you flew over the Atlantic, stopped up in Alaska and all the way across the United States, and then flew all the way over the Pacific. So that traffic, with the opening of the airspace, the block time savings, fuel sources, et cetera, over near Baku and Astana and Kazakhstan, or Astana and Kazakhstan. It's the economics are very difficult to compete. The U.S. to Asia traffic, however, I'm not the expert on that. I would defer to Mr. Parrott, who's up next. That's the predominant market share that you see in Alaska right today. So I don't know if that answers your question, but as far as getting the Europe to Asia traffic back, I guess my opinion would be that it's predominantly, we've kept tabs with those folks. We've stayed in contact with them. We still have great relational equity with all the airlines that operated at Fairbanks. And absent some geopolitical event that may occur, that to which I'm not sure that we have much control over, if any, the economics are far superior under the existing routings they're taking. Right. So.
Understood. Representative Salmon?
Yes. Could you go back to the first slide that we've seen on the airport, the overview?
The one?
The international airport, yeah.
Sure. This one?
That one, I think that'll...
And then I think it
maybe the next one.
This
no?
one?
Go ahead. Forward.
This one?
It could barely show. The one previous to that.
I think this was the first one, Representative.
Forward. Forward.
Yeah, forward. Go forward.
Okay.
One more. Yeah, right there.
Yep.
If you see on the east map there?
Yes, sir.
And right about where Warblow is at.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Warblow's there now. You don't see them there. But anyway, there's a bottleneck right there where, I don't know if you know where Arctic Aviation is at.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an incident there during the heavy snow this year. We had about a foot of snow. I don't know if you remember that. But anyway, they had an incident there. It seems like there's a bottleneck problem there, you know, because the hangar's too close to the rampway there. If you'll see that little white hangar right there, kind of.
Chair, with your permission, can I stand up?
Yeah.
Representative Salmon, this one?
No, keep going this way.
To the north?
Yeah. Keep going. Right. Keep going right there.
Right here?
The white one. Yeah, that's Arctic Aviation right there. Okay. And anyway, they had an incident there this winter when they had a heavy snow. Mm-hmm. The private person that's operating that hangar was moving, you know, switching airplanes around. The only way you could switch airplanes is move them onto that ramp, that taxiway there. And they had a little incident with Warblows, because Warblows wants to try to get out of there, and that's the only way out of there, because unless you go all the way around, but you can't escape around that way unless you go on the main runway. So their hangar is down there, and you know, if they're pulling planes in and out, they have to operate on that taxiway, and that was the problem they had, and I think that issue need to be resolved. And if you look at probably the police report and the airport manager's report over there, I'm sure you'll see it. It happened about 2 or 3 weeks ago when they had that heavy snow.
Oh, okay. Well, I can certainly look into it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions for Fairbanks? Seeing none, we're going to take a brief at ease and nobody gets to leave the room.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Parrott. I'm the Deputy Director at Anchorage International Airport. The Airport Director, Mort Plum, is out of state today and sends his regards. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to discuss what's happening at the Anchorage International Airport. Anchorage International Airport had some rather humble beginnings many years ago, but through the last 50-plus years, this is a 1950 shot of the airport, the airport has developed and grown into a world-class facility. The goals of the airport are to provide value to our customers, reduce cost, and increase our productivity. We have some sub-goals. Obviously, safety is a primary function of an airport. We're also very, very emphatic about security, satisfaction. We are firm believers in managing the money, providing quality service, and environmental stewardship. One of the primary functions at the airport is cargo, as Jesse has alluded to. That is very big here in Alaska. We are the number one airport in the United States for landed cargo weight, and we're the number three airport in the world for cargo throughput, and I'll talk some more about that in just a little bit. By virtue of our location in the state's largest city, we are a very busy passenger airport, serving as a gateway for people coming into and out of the state of Alaska. Our passenger traffic, as many of you are already very aware of, is rather seasonal. We do approximately 50% of our passenger traffic in the 4 months of summer. We arguably have the busiest float plane base in the world. That is a claim we continue to make, and no one has yet raised any serious argument with it. And all that combined makes the Anchorage International Airport, Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport, a wonderful place to work, and this is the shot that we like, looking out over the lakes at the city of Anchorage and the Chugach Mountains in the background. As I said, we are an international cargo airport. We consider ourselves world-class. We have the same benefit that Fairbanks does, in that we are 9.5 hours from 90% of the industrialized world. And if you look at the list of cities there, you'll see many market centers, shipping centers, and manufacturing centers, and we're beneficially located between them. To give you an example of the economics that were sort of discussed previously, there are aircraft in this day and age that can overfly Alaska and fly directly from Asia to the United States, to the lower 48. The MD-11, as an example, can do that, has a range 6,000 miles, and it can carry 65,000 kilograms of cargo. If that same aircraft stops in Anchorage, it flies an extra 100 miles, spend 2 hours on the ground getting refueled, it can carry an additional 45,000 kilos of cargo. At a nominal rate of $2 per kilo, that's an extra $90,000 for one airplane, one flight. If you do that with, as many carriers do, up to 5 airplanes a day, that's $450,000 a day. If you do that 5 days a week, that's $2.25 million a week. And if you do that 52 weeks a year, it's $117 million for 100 miles per airplane and a two-hour stop in Anchorage. That's the economics that we feel is driving the traffic through Alaska between Asia and the United States. The ability to carry that additional cargo is what makes the difference. As an example of the impact that has had, in the year 2000, we had approximately 15 landings per week serving the China-U.S. market. That has grown fantastically to where in 2007 we have approximately 260 landings per week. Nearly 35% of the total international cargo traffic going through Anchorage serves the China market. This is a list, and I do apologize for the color, this is a list of carriers that serve the China-U.S. market. And in addition to this list, I can tell you that every carrier that we know of that serves the Asia-U.S. market lands at least some of their flights in Anchorage to take advantage of that payload range equation. From 1995 to 2005, the scale isn't visible there, but I can tell you that our cargo aircraft landed weight has doubled in that time period. As I said before, if you look at cargo landed weight in the United States, we are the number one airport in that category. There's another method of measuring it, and if you use the cargo throughput, we're number three in the world behind Memphis and Hong Kong. Virtually any way you measure it, Anchorage International Airport is a significant cargo airport. The economic impact of that airport to the Anchorage area is that we directly and indirectly provide, according to the most recent ICER study, 1 in 8 jobs in the Anchorage area, about $562 million in direct annual payroll, and another $288 million in annual payroll for community jobs. Looking at the total economic impact, there's about $2.36 billion that goes into the economy because of the airport. The largest bulk of that is obviously $1.4 billion in fuel, $83 million in construction, $30 million in hotel for air crews, and that $850 million in payroll that I mentioned before. In order to continue to meet the needs of the people that want to use the airport, it does require infrastructure development. We make every attempt to manage the money doing that, and as Jesse pointed out, there are no state general funds used at the airport. Public infrastructure investment over the next few years. There's obviously a fairly long list there. A couple of the items stand out. The Concourse AB remodel, if you've been through the airport in the last year, you've seen that work going on, and that will continue through the fall of 2009. The other item there that stands out is the Operations and Facilities Center. That will be a building that will connect the north and south terminals. As you look at this artist rendering, the south terminal is on the left, the north terminal would be on the right. This will house several sections at the airport, a communications center, an emergency operations center, our facilities section, operations, and police, as well as providing covered, enclosed pedestrian walkway between the two terminals. We feel that we managed to do all of this while keeping our fees very reasonable. If you compare our landing fees for 747-400 to other well-known airports, we're clearly in the running as the most economical. And in addition to the landing fees, our rental rates for terminal space compared to airports both in the United States and Canada also appear to be fairly reasonable. The landing fees were predicted and forecast when we sold bonds in 1999. The left-hand bar, or the red bar, is the forecast. The right-hand bar, or the more blue bar, is the actual landing fee for that forecast period. And as you can see, with one small exception, we have been very near and slightly to greatly under the forecast landing fee. As a result of that and the strength of our traffic at the airport, in 2005, we were able to receive bond rating upgrades from each of the three rating agencies. In order to take care of the 4,000 plus acres, the 5 million passengers, the 37,000 wide-body landings per year, and over 1 million square feet of facilities, we have a staff of 380 airport employees and an operating budget of approximately $55 million. As you can see from this chart, it is a little complicated, but what the chart basically shows is that we budget on a monthly basis, knowing that there are seasonal variances between how much we're going to spend. We have some months that we know it's going to be heat, some months it's going to be de-icing chemical, so we don't just flatline our budget. Last year, we were able to watch our expenditures and return approximately $1.5 million to the airlines. In fiscal year 08, we are on track and hope to stay on to under budget. One of our goals you probably saw on the first slide was customer service. Customer service is a very wide-ranging and encompassing aspect at the airport. There's our service to our tenants as well as our tenant service to our passengers. We have a mystery shopper program where we have people go out and buy books, buy candy bars, buy dinners at the various vendors in the airport, and then rate those folks. And then we have an award program where the outstanding customer service people do get rewarded. In addition, the airport has been recognized for its service to our tenants through a couple publications, and it is always nice to receive third-party validation that that your customer thinks you're doing a good job. One of the things we're most proud of is that the airport is the four-time recipient of the Balkan Post Award. That is the award given nationally for outstanding snow and ice control. And we share a motto with at least one other commercial enterprise that we never close, although the 100-mile-an-hour winds did shut us down for wind once, but the just incredibly dedicated group of employees that helped take care of the snow there. On the environmental stewardship side, we have a recycling program. We recycle cardboard, recycle paper. We have significantly improved the water quality in Lakes Hood and Spinard by keeping the glycol out of there, so much so that now we had to buy a lake lawnmower to get the weeds out of the lake, which started to grow because the water was so good. And we also have a residential sound insulation program, which helps mitigate the noise of the airport. Current issues that we're looking at, the FAA reauthorization bill in Congress, Coolis Air National Guard Base, which was on the BRAC list, and that property will be coming back into the airport inventory. We're currently negotiating a new operating agreement with the airlines, as well as we're in the midst, a little over halfway done with a master plan. Items on our horizon looking forward. Several airports that you may have traveled in have had hotels built on them. We've had an independent consultant come in and run the business model. We've put out a request for interest and had several organizations interested in building a hotel at the airport, so that's something we're looking into. We're also looking at development of the West Air Park, which is one of the last big areas available at the airport. Development of that area may require a tunnel under runways to get to it. And the master plan that we're currently undergoing is looking at the potential need for an additional north-south runway. In addition, the existing air traffic control tower is in a very prime piece of real estate, and we'll be looking at the potential of moving that. And that concludes the prepared remarks, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me what your how your operating budget matches your revenue? Same question as Fairbanks.
Yes, ma'am. Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, the airport system is set up on a residual arrangement, which means the airlines have signed up that they will agree to pay the bills at the end of the year. So it's a situation where our revenues and our expenses can't be very far off. Whatever it costs to operate the airport, the airlines have agreed to fund. So Anchorage, as Jesse said, the system, we have revenue from landing fees, from terminal rent, from airport parking. All of that goes into the revenue side, and then what it costs to plow the snow, keep the lights on, pay the utility bills, and pay the people comes out of that.
Mr. Chairman, the follow-ups all have to do with that concept. Previous in your conversation or your testimony today, you said you returned the money to the airlines, so that's in reference to this agreement?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am. The agreement says that the airlines agree to pay the bills. At the same time, the airport cannot make a profit. So if there is excess revenue that's been collected through landing fees, that goes back, and I may have misled you by saying it goes back to the airlines. it may not be returned to them, but it will be credited toward the bills they have to pay during the next period.
So inside the contracts that you establish with the carriers that are flying into Anchorage International, the contract limits our profitability?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am. There is no profit allowed at the airport.
By state statute or by regulation?
I'm not sure if, through the chair, I'm not sure if that's a state statute or the FAA grant assurances.
I'm saying it's state statute, and I'm wondering, maybe someone can speak to later than why we would not. My concern is, or just I'm noticing, I don't know that it's a concern or not, that we have some of the lowest fees, at least in the landing fee survey and the terminal rental rate survey. And I'd just like to know the rationale behind being the lowest. And I'm coming off of voting against raising the taxes on oil in the special session because I was worried and concerned about the economy and the jobs that would be at risk or some kind of correlation between the two. And so
through the chair, Representative Fairclough, one of the limitations on any profitability that the airport would have or the airport system would have is that the FAA grant assurances would require that money be spent on the airports. You can't divert that revenue to other areas that the state might want to spend money on.
Mr. Chairman, I understand about the federal. I guess it would be helpful to see your pie chart as far as the federal revenues, and I know that they come in just because I worked with the municipality of Anchorage, so I know how Merrill Field is set up to receive quite a few federal grants to support their airports, but I guess the question is, do other airports operate at a profit in the United States? All airports are federally subsidized and require no profits? I'm seeing people shake their heads.
There may be private airports that don't receive federal funds that can operate at a profit, but to the best of my knowledge, any airport that receives federal funds is not allowed to divert any profit outside the airport. In fact, Los Angeles ended up paying back several million dollars that the FAA determined they had diverted from the airport.
Before we go on, I'd invite Ms. Klein. She's nodding her head on a couple questions, so if we get her on the record, maybe we can go back to the first one that you asked.
It's just along this line, so I'm not sure who can answer the question.
Can you come up to the and please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm Christine Klein, Deputy Commissioner of Transportation. With respect to your question regarding airports being profit centers, they are not allowed under federal regulation as federal public facilities to garner profit from the airlines. There are different agreements at different airports. Some are revenue, are residual type agreements, some are compensatory. But because the airports are the infrastructure for the airports has been given through the Federal Aviation Administration, they're not allowed to take money back that can be used for the local community. Some airports, or most airports in the country, are actually community airports, not state airports. And that was to prevent revenue being diverted into roads, marine highways, and other community needs around the country. And this is a very old regulation. I can get you the information, the regulation, and send it out to you.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm sorry. I'd like to know the nuts and bolts of things. Does the state contribute anything to the airport from our general fund or any other sources beside the enterprise agency itself?
Through the chair to Representative Fairclough. This is a tough question. The Department of Transportation, the State Department of Transportation, does provide services through aviation design, planning, and engineering. So there are services that the international airports utilize in order to carry out engineering design and construction. There are also accounting functions that are also provided, and human resources functions. Those are typically paid for through an ICAP on all projects. from the state of Alaska to the Enterprise Fund. So they're charged for those services. Whether or not it's a one-to-one ratio, I cannot answer. We'd have to research that.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Klein, nice to meet you. My thought process is, I think that it's outstanding that we offer low terminal rates and landing fees, but we have a ferry system who is collapsing under its own weight as far as us and our ability as a state to provide service to communities. And if we can offer air service to the communities at a lower fare than we can subsidize ferries, then maybe we should be building gravel runways and not investing in ferries. So I'm trying to see, I understand enterprise agencies and the concepts, but if there's something that we're not billing inside of the costs for your terminal rate fees or your landing fees, that's where my question is going, to see if we're not recapturing all the money, then there are costs that your carriers are not bearing that are part of the expenses. And I don't really need an answer right now. It's just that, and the question may not be as significant today as it will be in 5 years when we really start getting tight on a budget. Can you analyze that for me and
yes,
get back to us?
We will get some information out to you on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if your budget every year is sort of net zero, however you arrange that, and you want to build a new runway, you're issuing bonds to do that?
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, at this point, the master plan is studying the need and feasibility of a new runway.
Uh-huh.
Should a new runway prove to be needed, there would be first of all, an attempt to procure some measure of federal funds to increase the national air transportation system. And then the remainder of that portion, there would be a variety of funding strategies, which may very well include bonding some portion of it and then paying that back through funds, through the landing fee that the air carriers are charged.
Mr. Chairman, if you say a variety of funding strategies, do those funding strategies typically involve coming to the state for money for these projects?
No, sir.
Okay. And so I'm trying to figure out exactly how you get to zero at the end of the year. Do you structure your rates to Do you estimate your budget and then structure your rates to hit zero?
Through the chair, yes, sir. And those rates are adjusted, can be adjusted through the year. If we see that our expenses are low, we can lower the rate for the next period. If expenses have gone up, say utilities have gone up, we may raise the rate. So it's not fixed for the entire year.
So if you've had the pretty substantial growth in cargo landings that the charts show, has there then been a reduction in the amount of money that the passenger airlines are paying you?
Through the chair, sir, there is a formula that is incredibly complex, but the terminal cost and the airfield cost are all factored together, and the landing fee pays currently for the airfield and some of the terminal, and the terminal rent pays the remainder of the terminal or passenger portion. Right. So those go back and forth in a rather complex relationship.
Here's what I'm trying to get at. If I'm flying a Penn airplane into the Anchorage airport and the chairman's flying a JAL 747 cargo plane.
Or catch a can.
Full of bridge parts. sorry, couldn't resist. We're paying different landing fees to put our planes on the ground?
Chair, yes, sir. It's a landing fee per 1,000 pounds of certified max gross takeoff weight.
Okay, so essentially the increase in cargo landings has done what to the passenger landing fee? Has it depressed it? Has it held it steady? What's happened there?
Through the chair, yes, sir. More cargo landings keeps the overall landing fee down. That's for everybody.
Huh. And yet my airline tickets don't ever seem to go down. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How does that work when different cities contribute to lower individual carriers' rates? We don't take that into effect. So we're fixed on our operating costs, basically, or any revenue generation as far as that goes. But very frankly, Juneau contributes, is my understanding, and maybe I have it wrong, to Alaska Airlines in an effort to offer constituent fares, that they actually do a grant to the airline. And if I'm all wrong, just tell me. So the airlines inside of their business model are acquiring local contributions to fly in, but we're not.
Through the chair, there are certain mechanisms that can be used to encourage additional service to an airport, such as waiving landing fees for the first three flights a week or mechanisms like that. To the best of my knowledge, at the international airport system, other than the grant that Jesse talked about, we participate in, we don't have any such mechanisms going on right now, although we would entertain them to increase service. Existing service is generally not eligible for any such incentives.
Mr. Chairman, is it fair to say that you're working somewhat on an LLC model where there's a percentage of ownership then, or some kind of a shared expense ratio?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, one of the things that the airlines get in exchange for basically underwriting the airport is that they get a vote and an input on the capital projects, which are one of the big drivers of cost. So we don't simply have the opportunity or to go out and build anything we want. We go through the airline committee and seek approval for capital projects before we go out and build them. They don't have a veto capability, but they do have a significant input.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this takes me down a whole other lane. How do we attract business then and not get into antitrust violations under that scenario? How were we ever successful in getting FedEx in as a carrier to create employment in Anchorage? Why would everyone vote for that if they wanted? Why would FedEx vote for UPS to come in? Or
through the chair, Representative Faircloth, they don't vote for a particular airline to come in. They may vote for a taxiway project or a runway project that will benefit their operation also. And one of the ways we attract the FedExes and the UPSs and the JALs and the Cathay Pacifics and all the rest are those low landing fees and keeping the airport open.
I'll dig on that one on my own later. Mr. Chairman, my last question, I believe, is under your grouping, under an LLC model, it's my understanding that Ted Stevens International has greater revenue than Fairbanks International. And I know we use them as a secondary landing site to be able to operate ours. And the last I heard, so this number could be way off, is that Anchorage allocates about $8 million to Fairbanks International to keep that airport healthy. I'm not sure. To keep the runway viable so that we have a secondary landing site. How inside of your model under federal guidelines does everyone put two airports, multiple airports together in their scenario for looking at the costs? I'm trying to get back to the low landing fees. You're using two airports now and we're making a contribution, as I understand it, from planning and zoning when I served in Anchorage. We're contributing to make sure we have our secondary landing facility for any overflights because of weather, but we're basing our landing fees contributing to Fairbanks. How do you group those together?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, a couple items come to that. We are not two separate airports for accounting purposes. We are the Alaska International Airport System, so Anchorage doesn't allocate money to Fairbanks. All the revenue goes in, and then the expenses are drawn out as needed. It is very unusual for two airports to be linked together. One of the reasons for that is because, once again, if you look at the globe, there are no other airports within about 3 hours of flying that can handle the large aircraft on a regular basis. In the lower 48, the rest of the area governed by the FAA, there are numerous airports around that can serve as divert bases. So you don't have to have, you know, two airports tied together in some sort of symbiotic relationship. So this is a relatively rare case of joining two airports and dealing with them as a sort of as a single entity. And the landing fees are the same at both airports because it's a system. So which airport they land at doesn't compete against the other.
Follow-up.
Is the reason proximity why we don't use a military facility as a backup airport?
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, I don't believe the military would allow us to land civilian aircraft there most of the time. That would be for security reasons.
Representative, are you Representative Dugan?
Just one question, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming that there are a lot of smart people at DOT and they've already thought about this, but I guess there's, since we've got such a big demand for spending in the rural airports, I would suppose that there's no way to tie all the airports together. Is that correct?
More international ones.
Through the chair, Representative Dugan, I don't believe we've been able to find a way to do that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Faircloth.
If the two airports being in one pool together is unique or rare, is it because they're both international airports that that's allowed to transpire?
Chair, to Representative Faircloth. There's some history here that I may be able to help. The two airports were at one time one. The management and the staff support were shared. As the airports grew, they started to separate out. At this time, there are still shared staff, the accounting staff, the controllers, and one system position. As far as I know, there may be a couple of other positions as well. But they share resources because they are under the same operating agreement and share rates and fees. They also have, for the most part, the same airline mix. I don't know if that answered your question, but that was part of the reasoning, and being in the same system, and that it was the only other airport to go to quickly in the event of an emergency.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Any other questions? I just had a question about the hotel. In the airport, you go to Chili's or the other vendors. How is that set up? And I'm just curious as to how the airports are going to go into the hotel business. Is that common? And
Mr. Chairman, no, sir, that would not be common. The airport would not be in the hotel business. A hotel would be located at the airport, much like a restaurant like Chili's is located at the airport. They would be a tenant. They would pay rent. They would pay a percentage of their revenue.
That's very reassuring. Representative Faircloth.
So on that point, we'd be issuing a long-term lease?
Through the chair, yes, ma'am, that's what we would anticipate doing.
We would not sell? And then
through the chair, no, ma'am.
And we would have a reverter clause then for the asset at a particular point in time?
Through the chair, the standard leases that the airport have, the property always belongs to the airport. The improvements at the end of the lease, the tenant either with the airport's approval leaves them or is required to take them with them.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You take the hotel with Representative Keller.
Would you expand? You made a comment, I think it was the West Apron, you said it's the last thing to be that is not developed. Is that the area west of the north-south? Is that what you,
Through the chair, Representative Keller, there is a large swath of land that is airport property west of the current north-south runway that is still available for development.
is there a conjecture? What's the guess on where the hotel would go? The tunnel, I assume you're talking the south of the runway, maybe?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, the tunnel on a previous master plan was anticipated to be north of the north terminal, north of Taxiway Victor, just about where the post office is, and it would proceed west from there. The hotel is anticipated to be, because the model that's working at other airports is for the hotel to be very near, if not connected, to the passenger terminal.
Representative Faircloth?
I apologize to committee members. For monopolizing the conversation.
Well, I thought it was about the Marine Highway.
No. No, Mr. Chairman, I think that we need to address marine highways, too. This is just our air highways. In the city of Anchorage, we have conflict between airport growth and usage, so I have a couple questions. One, your airspace, is there problems? Because even though we have some of the highest numbers for bush pilots and that float plane landing is, I believe, highly used. And we just had a crash last year or the year before on the lake, on Lake Hood, as I recall. And so I'm wondering how much airspace time we actually have left or whether it can expand. And then the follow-up to that is the land use around the airport is causing conflict. So, again, looking at your low rates for your field, I'm wondering whether it would be in the state's best interest to acquire the property that is adjacent to our air traffic pattern as it becomes available so that we're starting to have to pay for insulated roofing, windows being repaired, and we're getting increased conflict between neighbors. And so I'm wondering, I've watched inside of Anchorage in the last decade where the airport's being encroached on basically by developers picking up 5-acre parcels or something in the Jewel Lake area. And I'm wondering if it's part of your master plan or whether it should be to reduce that conflict and provide future growth opportunities, whether we would look at purchasing that because we have opportunity.
Through the chair, Representative Faircloth, that you raised several very interesting points. As to the ability of the airspace to handle more traffic, that is being analyzed by the master plan team, as well as there is currently an FAA team from the lower 48 that is looking at reallocating and reapportioning, redrawing the airspace all over Alaska, but specifically in the Anchorage Bowl area, to try to make it as efficient as possible. So that airspace is being looked at. As for the land use around the airport, there are some areas, as an example, the subdivision just off the north end of Lake Hood Strip. There's a little piece that juts out into the line of traffic, and that is an area that we are looking to acquire when it becomes available to meet some FAA safety area requirements. We're also working with the municipality as they go through their zoning and planning process to try to make sure that the airport and the areas around it are zoned appropriately so that we don't end up with residential subdivisions in places where it will cause conflicts in the future.
I appreciate you working with the municipality, but at least last year, the housing market's downturned right now as far as new development and construction goes across our nation right now. But specific to the property adjacent to the airport, people are moving in and then after the fact coming to the city and complaining. And so I don't know if there's a way that we can measure the noise level out in the circumference of the airport to start mitigating that now, because if we don't mitigate it now, we're going to have a long-term problem where we continue to be, as a state, faced with people saying that we're affecting their quality of life. And so it would be much better while there's still a little bit of property left to look at that issue now. There has been conversation in the past, if I might, Mr. Chair, to separate the freight away from passenger mobility, which could, if there was a redrawing of airspace at a federal level, and then I don't want Representative Keller to come unglued, but if by chance the bridge were successful, that Mat-Su is actually the point, is one place that I had heard rumors, just tell those listening on gavel to gavel, I don't know this to be true, but rumors of a fire island and a causeway or out in Mat-Su for the separation of the freight service. So if you could just speak to that.
Through the chair to Representative Faircloth. Yes, there are a number of things that are going to be considered, including that potential in the Alaska Airport System Plan. It has not been updated since about 1996. Those plans are part of the National Transportation System and have to integrate in with it. At this time, we are starting the Alaska Airport System Improvement Plan. And there was a kickoff approximately a month ago, and it will cover all of Alaska, all the regions and communities, and look at forecasts for traffic, what changes have been over the last 10 to 15 years, what the demand will be for the next 30 years, and what improvement may be needed in Alaska to make the system whole. I would encourage everyone to participate in those public meetings and the surveys that are going out. They will be over the next year and a half all throughout Alaska looking at public issues, transportation issues, what the demand, what the capacity is. But that will be one of the issues that is looked at. It's been brought up to the department's attention.
Representative Keller.
Representative Faircloth saw my question coming, so.
Oh,
right. I can't help but comment that there's room on Point McKenzie. And of course, that is, you answered the question. I'm sure this airport system improvement plan has in its scope the whole area. So I'll be watching. Thank you.
Yes, it does.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
No, that was good.
We've got just a couple of minutes left, and I apologize for not doing this in advance, but I'd like to hear kind of an introduction of how you got to be the director of aviation. What have you been doing in the past, and how did you end up in room 120?
Thank you. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, and I had been working in airports for about 13 years in the international airport system. When I departed, I believe it was 2005, from the international airport system here in Alaska, I went back into the private sector and have been running an engineering company the last couple of years. And I was honored when the governor and commissioner called and asked me to take this challenging position. It took some convincing, but I'm glad to be here back in aviation and look forward to working with you all. I grew up in rural Alaska in a small community outside of Ketchikan. And I'm very familiar with the marine highway system as well as aviation, as that was the only way to get to my homestead. So I hope that you have faith in my ability. I am an accredited airport executive, and my background is in engineering from the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Excellent. And just before we go, and I know you've only been here a short time, but you get into the office, what is the big thing on your plate that jumps out that's the biggest challenge for you in your new job?
Well, I think the biggest challenge will be funding for our rural airports, that they are critical to Alaska, to its future economy and the people. And the greatest challenge will be trying to figure out how to fund and operate those airports, the 256 airports throughout the state. And the safety of those airports. They are the only link to medical facilities for most of our citizens, and they need lighting and they need maintenance and operations to keep them safe. So that will be probably the biggest challenge and is certainly one of my top priorities.
Representative Faircloth.
Ms. Klein, did you serve as the chair of the transition team for DOT?
Yes, I did. The governor asked me to be her transportation transition team lead, and I selected the 18 members of the team from throughout the state of Alaska, and we completed our report in about 3 weeks, I believe.
As I recall, one of the issues that your transition team came up with was a lack of morale and personnel problems in DOT.
That
Can you
is
tell
correct.
Me how you're going to address that, or if you think that's still there?
Yes, through the chair to Representative Faircloth. I have heard morale continues to be a problem, and I'll be working with the commissioner to improve morale and get out and see the troops out in the trenches and listen to their concerns very actively.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just would be interested. My understanding from the commissioner's testimony is that that had changed. And that that he had done at least one survey, if not multiple surveys, or a second one was going out. I'm not sure. I'm just vaguely remembering conversation that we asked him about that particular point. And so as you're, how long have you been on the job?
About 3 days.
That's what I was thinking. You've done an excellent job presenting today. You're very well spoken, and I appreciate you moving from the private sector, which I would guess was a testimony to your willingness to want the state to be the best it can be in understanding those pay grade differences. So thank you for that. Anyway, if you could get back to me after you've had your feet on the ground for a while, I got on my little soapbox the other day, because we really do want to understand transportation as it affects our communities, specifically Representative Salmon in rural areas, and Ketchikan was highly disappointed in losing a very well known project that was near and dear to their hearts, and so we've been going through a somewhat laborious process, and at our last meeting I came unglued a bit and just wanted everyone to know that we know that there are many fine people working in DOT, and I went to the chair, and what I said was I don't want people in the trenches to think just because we're trying to figure out where the administration and the leadership is taking us that we don't truly want to say out loud that we understand that there are many fine people, including leadership in the department, that are doing excellent work for Alaskans. So, but I would like a report back on morale and how we're going to value our employees and how we make sure that they know that they are doing the work for the citizens of Alaskans.
Through the chair to Representative Fairclough, I believe there is a survey underway. I don't think it has been completed yet. An employee survey through the Department of Transportation right now. I'm sure once that survey is complete that will findings could be shared. But that is not completed right now. But that is one of the things that the commissioner is doing to assess the situation. And also getting out and seeing employees. He's also been doing that. So I think there have been some improvements. It's also in the middle of winter. So, we have cabin fever here in Alaska. Thank you.
One real quick final question. I think you two need to get running off to Hess, but in Ketchikan, the borough runs the airport. What sort of implications for your division if that airport is given back to the state to take care of? How do you feel about such a thing? And including access to the airport.
To the chair, I'd have to research that a bit. At this point, the department generally encourages communities to keep their airports because they have the greatest interest in maintaining them and caring for them. In the situation of Ketchikan, I'd have to look into some of the issues there and some of the concerns. But I can't imagine that the department would want to take it back if they could help it. We have, as you well know, a lot of operating and maintenance concerns and budget shortfalls. And in the case of Ketchikan, it is linked with the ferry, or the Ketchikan ferry, and it is a Ketchikan Gateway Borough Airport, as I recall, and some of the infrastructure is owned by the borough. So it's a little more complicated in the case of Ketchikan.
So if the state were, for some reason, to have an airport dropped in their lap and the borough decided it wasn't their problem to provide access, would the state need to take over getting people to the airport, or should we just put our dry suits on and swim on over?
I'm not sure on that. I'd have to take a look at the grant assurances.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. I appreciate
Thank you
spending the time.
Thank you.
Anything else before the committee? We'll go at adjourn, actually. Thank you.